interesting is the fact that she has to go through a period of Tara. And with Moshe made Tahara, Levain all of us, Tavi, Kevitz Mashiach Leolo, then Yonah Osir Lachata. I'll pass it on the way. The Kivah, the Chiper Alela, the Torah and Kardamela. Those Torahs are your letters for Zachar and Akeva. So, what, I think the question's pretty obvious, right?
What'd you do wrong, right?
Sorry?
What did she do wrong?
Yeah, well, right, what she did wrong. To the contrary, you think she did something right. That's the mitzvah to have a kid. So that's the question. Right? Have you thought about this question before? I'm sure you have.
Mm-hmm. Rebbe?
So it also says, it uses both terms. It says Kiper and Tahara.
Right.
So is that two separate things, meaning the Tahara is just because she's been Matame? Or is that also related to the Kapara?
No, the Tahara, there's two things. There's a Tuma. She goes through a period of Tuma.
Right, so the Tahara is just related to that.
And then there's a separate, but yeah.
Oh, okay.
Part of the process requires that you bring carbon.
Right.
Same.
And then keep here is...
Excuse me, the carbon, I would say, accomplishes two results.
Right.
One is kapara.
Okay.
Okay, and the other one is the, it's connected to the, I guess, the state of tuma is associated somehow, so it terminates the state of tuma.
Okay.
Yeah. The key question is, what is the... I was thinking, the general question that, how would you understand this? Why would you require a kapara? What was the sin? So it says the chiper. A chatas, we know, is associated with sin. And the chiper. It's an interesting chazal. Ramban, quote, Rabbi Seyu Amru, if you have Ramban there. Shoshe Korat Leleid when she goes into labor. Ophetes Vinishbat, she swears, she takes a shua, from Eskak O Davali. She's never going to be with her husband again. Each of Hakavanovas, I mean, this idea is Kibavursha, he Vishbat Mishokatar. Because she makes the shvua, you know, not in her right mind, because of the pain, the ena shvua ruuyil is kayin, and the shvua is not roi, to be maintained. But they also much better for Bala, because she is the experience of her husband. She's not abusing her to make this kind of shvua.
Yeah.
Yeah. Brought aside Torah, l'chapela, may, much of the Elvas, Rucha, the Torah wants to atone for her because of this thing that she said, the foolishness. That's what he says. The Mach may is, the Rach of Hashem is Barach Amuka, the foot of God are very deep, the Racham of Merubim, his mercies are very abundant, the Rota Lahatsi Priota. He wants to be mastic, to testify, so to speak, his creation. That last thing is cryptic. But the whole idea of this chazal is very difficult. Right, guys?
Well, you say she swears she won't be with her husband again.
Yeah.
That's what you talk about. That's because of tsar, and it's not something which is fitting to be maintained. So therefore, it's not a good shvur, or is?
No, it's not a good shvur. I would say he's saying it's not a good shvur. And the problem with this is, what do you mean? Hold on a second. Let me put the tape. I haven't been taping because I'm just talking. Let me start the tape. All right, so you'll bear with me. What do you guys think? I'm just going to pretty much repeat what I just said. Thank you. taking up the question of Tazia. And one strange aspect describes different things that have to be done after a woman gives birth to a child, whether it be a son or a daughter. And it seems strange that this causes us to go into a period of tuma, uncleanliness, generally translated as ritual uncleanliness. And that period culminates, it's different for whether it be a boy or a girl, but in either case, it says that at the conclusion of this period, that he has to bring sacrifices. And one of them is the olah, the burnt offering, but then she has to bring a sin offering. And the sin offering is associated with having done navera, sin, and it says that she'll bring it and she'll have an atonement. So therefore, it would seem that she requires an atonement, and that's the culmination that she receives an atonement, and the state of tuma, of uncleanliness, comes to an end, and she becomes tahora. So the question that we're asking is, what does she require an atonement for? What did she do wrong? What was the sin? To the contrary, having a child is a very big mitzvah. Okay, that was the question. Hold on, I'm still, I'm just going to put one number to Ramban on in a second. I'm just glancing through the various commentaries. The Ramban quotes the Gemara, which is Nida Lamed Aleph, Amud Bey, which says something that on the surface is strange and needs to be analyzed, to the effect that the woman goes through great pain in labor, and at a certain point in the labor, I guess when she's not really in her right mind, she doesn't really mean it seriously, but due to the extreme pain that she's in, she swears that she's not going to be together with her husband again. That is to say, for purposes of a sexual relationship, because of the pain as children. And the basic idea, this is associated, this apparently is a reference to that which is sinful and requires an atonement. And the basic idea is that since she only took this oath due to the extreme pain, and it's not an oath which can be maintained because of her relationship with her husband, so the Torah wanted to give her an opportunity to atone from that which she said in this moment when she was overcome by her emotion. Then the Ramban adds that the thoughts of God are very deep and his mercies are abundant, but he wants to justify his creation, to give them a chance to be righteous. That last part, that latter part is also strange. I mean, the whole thing is strange, so let's analyze it. Let's analyze it. We'll see where we go. We can come up with something, can't come up with something, but let's analyze it. The first thing is, what's the kasha? The kushiyos. List the questions. Nothing? Alright, so maybe it's no question, so it's perfect sense. So what's the problem? Now you know the answer.
If the Torah had not said this here, wouldn't we have been able to remove the shvuah anyway?
Without this karban.
Right. Without in standard shvuahs.
Yeah. You mean does the person need a kapara when they take the shvuah? That's a good question. Yeah. Very good question. But there's, on the surface, this statement of Chazal is difficult. For if the entire kapara is based upon the assumption that she's taken an oath,
but she doesn't take it.
Don't interrupt me.
You know we're taping.
I turn it over to you guys and you don't say anything.
I'm sorry, I didn't know that we were taping.
No, didn't I say I'm taping now? Alright, whatever the case. Now I'm taping. At first I was just talking, I think I'll tape it. If I don't want to put it out there, I won't put it out there. Okay, it's okay. No problem. Well, let me just say what I think the problem is. Are we assuming that an actual oath took place? That's very, very difficult. It's possible that it did. However, this is the description in every case. It would seem that if the idea is based upon this oath, so then it should only be in those cases where an oath was taken. And that's something which is verifiable. If everybody who was present, in those days they had midwives. Today you're in a hospital, you have doctors. Everybody can attest that the person didn't take an oath. And today you have these different, the natural childbirth, and the woman is awake, whatever. It's known whether she made such an oath or not. And if it's based purely on the oath, then what about all the cases where the oath does not take place, where a woman doesn't take this oath? Moreover, if it's a matter of an oath, so why isn't it treated like a regular oath? There are times when a person, because of very severe stresses or emotions, will take an oath, which upon a thought, they later regret. And there's ways of dealing with it. A person can have their oath nullified. That's precisely the idea. When we do nullify an oath, known as hataras nedarim, it's part of the idea that we regret. And had we known the consequences and where it would lead to, we would never have done it in the first place. Essentially, we didn't do it in our right mind. And then the oath can be nullified in front of three people that would constitute a best thing for that purpose. And there's no indication that a specific kapara or atonement is required in that case. Indeed, that's the correct thing to do. That you, if you take an oath and you see that you can't keep it, and then that's a very serious avera, it's a very serious sin to violate the oath, so then a person should make use of the means of extricating himself. So this whole thing sounds very difficult. Then the additional statements of Ramban that the thoughts of God are very deep indicate that there's something unique over here. Okay, these are the questions. Now, Yosef, go ahead.
That's what I was going to ask there.
Oh, okay. I gave the opportunity before I launched. So.
I didn't realize you were back into the tape.
All right. It's okay. Fine. You know, I'm back. We're back on course. All right. So, now, maybe some suggestions. This shows you, this is like really interesting. And nothing is simple in the Torah. Nothing is simplistic if you analyze it. I can't find where he says it though. It says Chippa Kashepi Rashi, like I explained, but I don't know where he explained it. Hey, general statistics, if you ask women, I would think, I don't know, maybe I'm wrong, but I don't think that most women make such a note. Sure.
They generally just curse out the word.
And the truth of the matter is that you see that women have a lot of children. A lot of women, depends on the woman, but in general, they want to have more children.
Maybe before the days of anesthesia.
It's before the days of anesthesia. Yeah, so you mean today it really has no shakas at all?
No.
You're saying it has no relevance today?
Well, I imagine it's still painful.
I'm sorry?
I imagine it's still painful, but...
Yeah, it's still painful. I don't know what they did in those days. I don't know that it's an interesting thing.
Rebbe?
It's an interesting thing. Hold your thought. It's interesting to note that, even though this is a serious thing, a woman in childbirth is considered to be in a state of lakana, Machal Shabbos, and all that, but this is something that's been going on from the dawn of history, when the medicine was in its most primitive... Right, most primitive conditions, and there's no evidence that that more people died in childbirth. I'm sure there were more, but nothing like significant. They found ways. That's an interesting fact. They've always found ways of doing it and having children. They multiplied and so on and so forth. In fact, Pharaoh wanted to have the midwives to execute the children. And they refused. But naturally, according to the natural order, they were always able to have children. They always found a way of doing it. Without all the modern antiseptic conditions. So I don't know that it was that much more painful. The contrary, I tell you the truth, I would imagine, I mean, I could be wrong on this, but I would imagine that people adapt to the situation. Today, we're more spoiled. So we're used to having more painkillers and so forth. So we don't have to resort to any kind of natural ways of dealing with certain situations. So then in those days, women didn't have these medicines and painkillers. They must have had other ways of adapting. They didn't have doctors. They had midwives. Midwives knew what to do. But all right. In all events, the explanation has to be something which applies to all times. It can't be something applied only to one time. You have to explain it that way. Moreover, even then, I don't think that every woman cursed. I'm not cursed. I'm sorry. I took an oath. Yeah. Yosef, if you want to say something.
The Ibn Ezra is in Perek Aleph Pasuk Dalet.
Perek Aleph Vayikra?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
So I'm not fair love.
How'd you find it?
I looked in Torah Chaim, his notes.
Oh, great. Aleph Yudalet.
Aleph Dalet.
Aleph Dalet.
V'chaper Aleph. I don't know what it means.
So are you referring to this? Leos Kofer Onish. Sheyeshalah. The question is atonement for the punishment that's on him.
In other words,
he's talking about Karbanos in general. That the person is really deserving a punishment. And instead of receiving the punishment, this is sort of an exchange. It's a ransom, so to speak. That is to say that he, through the Karban, he absolves himself from the need to receive the actual punishment that would be upon him. So all that he's talking about in general, but apparently he's applying that same concept here, which would seem to indicate that there's some requirement of a punishment. That's all I see over here, the one you showed me. Yeah, the point is like this. Are we going to take... You see, you have to make a decision at a certain point as to whether we're going to be taking the Chazal literally or not literally, but it's communicating an idea. There's two ways. Let me just put it down. There are two ways we can approach the statement of Chazal. If you approach it literally, then it's going to be very, very difficult. Because if you're going to approach it literally, you're going to have to assume it as a fact. And on a factual basis, it doesn't seem to hold. And you have all these questions, all these issues. That it's not true that it happens in every case, and even if it did, this is not the normal prescription for a oath. Or is it not meant to be taken literally, but that is the way they communicate a certain idea? It's more of a metaphorical phenomenon. That's the decision you have to make. I mean, derech-wise, I would advise that we don't take it literally. If you're going to take it literally, I can't go any further, really. The chair is over unless you find a different explanation, or somebody else has a different approach. There could be other approaches, by the way. I mean, you know, that's Chazal is saying one thing. There could be other things.
Right, man?
Yes.
I don't have the actual text. I have the art scroll, and they quote the Ibn Ezra. And it says over here that the elevation offering atones for resentful thoughts she may have had against her husband or even against God during her labor pains.
Okay.
Which would seem to imply that if she's thinking that's
a quote from the Ibn Ezra?
What?
It's a quote from the Ibn Ezra.
Yeah.
If you can get the source, I trust the article pretty much on this. I'm pretty good with the sources. I just want to get the source.
That's the Ibn Ezra. Let me just see.
Anybody able to just locate the Ibn Ezra so we know? Pasuk Vav, the Yeshavim Shaitama Keves Olaf, Shema also Shumach Shava Arucha. Maybe some thoughts came to her mind, Bishas Leidasa, Yerel Hatzar, because of the excessive pain. Chata Shema Dibro Bafiyot. And the Chata says maybe she spoke. Said something. say that's in Vav.
Yeah.
I guess but he doesn't say specifically thoughts against God.
Right.
They must be referring to resentful thoughts. And maybe there's a peerage on the Ibn Ezra. But again, so what was it, but according to that, why would she require, just because the person was in a situation that had some resentful thoughts, so what? You know, why is that, what's the sin? You know, now you're not allowed to have resentful thoughts anymore. To the contrary, if a person has thoughts and they don't, everybody has resentful thoughts. Right?
Well, you might say that it is a sin. I mean, philosophically, you might say there's something that is not, like, of the highest order, but there's usually not a korban on that.
Right, that's the problem. Albert? Reason for the burnt offering of a lamb, perhaps in her great distress, an evil thought entered her mind during childbirth. Yeah. An evil thought. But that's what it means. Obviously, that's what it means. You know, that makes sense. What kind of thought? She's resentful. Okay. So now...
resentful of God?
Resentful against her husband and, Yeah. Against God.
Sforno has a very different take on this.
Okay, let's do the Sforno.
It's on Pasuk Ches.
Okay. Is he parallel?
Yeah.
Well, why does he explain? What's the kapara for?
Seems to be saying because the entire time she's only thinking about stuff with the kid. So she needs kapara on that so she can get back to Kodesh stuff.
Okay, hold on. It's on the reproductive organs. So what? You know, what kind of thing is that? That's supposed to focus on the reproductive organs. Ready. A Pakula condition. He has some pretty good notes. Although he's explaining, although she is physically ready and ritually clean, mentally she's not yet geared to transcend the holy. This is sacred to me as Kavanah. She must wait until her thoughts are sufficiently disposed to focus on the non-physical, namely the spiritual and the holy. He's saying that during that time, our thoughts are concentrated on the reproductive organs and their functioning. That's what requires an atonement. That's strange. I don't immediately get it. I'm not sure. I have to think about that. Alright, so you have a few different things. Yeah, the evidence seems to be more in line with the Ramban. I mean, that's not the Ramban, it's really the Gemara. That you're not taking it literally that she actually makes an oath, and it's indicative of a state of mind. So let's learn it that way. It's very hard to say that this is an oath, and we're talking about the halachic. We have a different idea, but it's not based on interpreting the Ramban. It isn't to note there's a difference between the time periods from a boy and from a girl. As you know, right? 1 is 7 days. There's 2 periods of time, 1 is 7 days, and that's 33, right? Then for a girl, it's 14 and 66. I'm correct. Not correct. two time periods. One is a period for 7 or 14 days, which he has the status of being like a Yiga. Name Yiga Svota. It becomes like a Yiga. Yeah, there's two time frames. But you see it refers to 7 for a boy, 14 for a girl. Then it says that she's Matthias on that. So that's one type of tumma. Now let me just put it on thing. Just to look at the situation, it seems that there are two different time periods regarding purification of a woman who's had a child. And there's a difference between whether the child is a boy or a girl. The first is either a 7-day period of tumma, a boy, 14 if it's a girl. And then she purifies herself from that. The essence of that is that she attains status of being like a nisa, a menstruating woman. That those days are days in which the tumma has to do with the fact that she is prohibited from relations with her husband, as she would be when she isn't. That period lasts 7 days if it's a boy and 14 days if it's a girl. Then another period of tumma, uncleanliness, commences. There it's different regard to Kodesh, regard to holy things, and the Mikdash and so forth. But it's not with regard to forbidden relations. That period would be 33 days for a boy and 60 days for a girl. The basic idea is that the amount of time for a girl is twice the amount as it is for a boy, and that's the one, the culmination of which is brought about through the sacrifice of the karbanot, sacrifices, which we're focusing on. So yeah, that's just a general overview. Okay? It's also interesting, why should it be different for a boy or a girl? And explain it, but my explanation wouldn't be exactly in line. Maybe somehow in line with the Chazal. I mean, but I'll give you guys a few seconds. Yeah, the sin and the punishment of the woman, the SFTLB bottom.
Yeah.
Anybody refresh my memory a little bit? Remember you were saying that prior to the punishment, the ego factor involved in having a child would have been so great that it would have been a whole distortion, something like that. Can you help me here?
Yeah,
give a brief review if you remember.
Because I think, like, other than man and woman, they both wanted to feel like they have something.
Right.
And like the greatest feeling that a woman can have in her life is to be a creator.
Right.
That's like the greatest thing she can do.
Right.
And if she would, and if there was no postpartum depression, so she would be able to become completely absorbed in the satisfaction, the fulfillment that she would get out of doing that act of creation.
Right. Good. Yeah, I think that this is related. I think this is related to that whole thing. Okay? You see a connection already, right? The issue of childbirth is something which occupies a very significant place in the story of creation, for example. That was the essential punishment for the woman, that as a result of the sin, that she experienced depression, postpartum depression, and in general, pain, that the entire experience of having children would be associated with a lot of unpleasantness. As Rabbi Kate explains, it has to do with the fact that for the woman, this constitutes, the having a child constitutes the most powerful emotion that she would have in terms of her desire to be a creator, to fulfill the ego. And that's a very powerful drive in a woman. That's the most powerful drive. And I would say that's the reason why it was necessary that it was not connected with this type of pain and depression, just after the sin, the state that she was in prior to the sin, Adam and Chava were in a state of perfection, so then it would not have had a negative effect, because all their thoughts were geared towards understanding and knowledge, getting closer to God. But afterwards, in the state where, you know, the energy of the person is connected to the emotions, and now you have to be careful in terms of the emotional life. So the fulfillment of a person's most powerful drive has a distorting effect upon the ego. Now I would say, in a general sense, that what's going on over here is connected to that. And that the idea of the kapara, of the atonement, does not necessarily have to be for a specific avera. Of course, if a person commits a certain avera, then they have to bring a sacrifice. But essentially, it's not to the sin itself. What you're really atoning for is the underlying state of mind, the mentality behind which you were able to do the action. The action is only of any significance due to the fact that it reflects a certain distortion of the psyche. And that's really what you're supposed to focus in on. The person just brings the carbon, the sacrifice, it goes through the motions, it doesn't introspect, it doesn't do tshuva, eagerly, confession, tshuva. That's an essential component. Otherwise, the sacrifice really has no value. So, therefore, the truth of the matter is that philosophically, the concept of sacrifice does not necessarily have to involve a particular action of sin. It's a person recognizes that they're in a certain state of mind, even though they haven't done anything specifically, but the way their thoughts are going, the way their emotions are going, they need something which would sober them up and bring them back to reality. I think in that sense, that is the sense over here, that the having a child, giving birth to a child, is a profound experience for a woman, and I would say even for the husband as well. Everybody can relate to that. It is one of the most powerful instincts, the most powerful drive. More so for a woman. Because the woman is designated as the one who's going to have the children, and so she has the maternal instinct. The paternal instinct in the man is not as great, but the men too have a tremendous desire to have children. Everybody has a desire to have children for different reasons. It calls to mind all of the different emotions that people have. That's why it's considered to be a terrible tragedy if people are childless. And why is it a tragedy if people are childless? In terms of the Torah itself, the person keeps the Torah, doesn't the smoke? And so it's a mitzvah, it's another mitzvah to have children, of course, to be fruitful and multiply. However, if for whatever reason a person physically cannot have children, so as far as the Torah is concerned, there's no tragedy. This person is in compliance, fulfills the mitzvah. In truth, in terms of perpetuating Torah, teaching it to the next generation, doesn't have to be for your own biological child. A Rebbe is obligated to teach all students, and the truth of the matter is that they are referred to as his children. That's why the Rambam explains, B'nei Hanaviim. The students of the Nevi'im were called B'nei Hanaviim, the children. Because that's the essential relationship. The philosophical idea of the parent, the philosophical concept of the father, Abraham is called the father. He's the father of many nations. And the famous question that was asked the Rambam of the convert, that can be referred to our father Avram, Yitzchak and Yaakov, when indeed it's not his own father, he's a convert, he doesn't go back biologically to Avram. And the Rambam said, of course you can, because the concept of father is not intended biologically over here. The concept of father means, in terms of the essence of the person, which is the soul, and the person's basis, philosophy of life, approach, his ideas, everything is what he derives from Avram. He recognizes Avram as a teacher, so then he's truly, that's the truth, the child, the son of Avram. So all that would indicate that if a person is childless, because from a biological standpoint, he's not really childless. A person is a Rebbe, he has teachers, he has students, he has disciples. So in a philosophical sense, he's fulfilling all of this. Yet, we have to ask ourselves, why is it that most people would regard this as being a tragedy? I think that question is crucial here, in terms of opening it up. I think you'll agree that most people would view it that way, because you think people travel all over and they look for every type of, you see today that people, because there's new technologies, will do everything to search for any type of a scientific method by which they could have children. Different forms of fertilization and so on and so forth. Even if it's not really necessary, because according to Allah, they may not be required since they can't have children. Thus, you see that there's a tremendous drive. Now, do you see my connection, why I'm bringing this up?
Yeah. You're saying that through this whole process, it distorts her relationship to reality.
Exactly.
Very because good. She starts to feel that her entire idea about life becomes wrapped up in the life of this child.
Right.
And the reason they make it into the world to search the world to try to find a way to have children is because that desire becomes their world.
Right.
But that's not the reality of the Torah. The reality of the Torah is that this is really only a very small part of the total picture, and even if you can't do this, so there are still many other things that you can do that are just as important.
Exactly.
So the kapara is to bring her back to the correct ideas of reality.
Exactly. Yeah. Along these lines, then, it's clear that when the woman has a child, it's the fulfillment of the most powerful instinctual drive that she has. And there is a danger that she becomes completely absorbed in this project, and that's true, she becomes completely absorbed in it, and this has a distorting effect in terms of the true purpose of human existence. I would say that it also has an effect upon the husband as well, not to the same extent, because there's a very powerful emotion at work over here, and it has to do with the ego. The entire sense of a person's ego, self-importance, immortality. You see that, of course, we have a mitzvah to have children, but even without the mitzvah, the rest of the world, the Noahites, don't have a specific mitzvah to have children, but there's no danger that people are not going to have children. You don't need the mitzvah. In order to see that people will have children, you don't need the mitzvah. It's something which is ingrained in the human psyche. Everybody just takes it for granted. That's because it has to do this with many emotions. There's the maternal emotion, there's many emotions, but the key, and the reason why I think it's a tremendous tragedy, is because people look at that as a form of courage. That is, that you're not going to be perpetuated. This whole idea of being perpetuated, which has to do with the human desire for immortality. And as we said, from a philosophical standpoint, the real immortality, insofar as this world is concerned, would be in terms of influencing others. But on a personal, instinctual, emotional level, the phenomenon of having your own child is the fulfillment of a very powerful emotion, and any time a person is in a situation, I would say any time. You learn from this, and of course, the Torah is picking out something which is objective and universal, but it can apply to any other area. Whenever a person has a deeply seated emotional desire, a desire for a certain type of a success, to achieve what, and manifest itself in achieving something, then all goal in the world would be imaginary. People are trying to achieve a tremendous success in business, to obtain a certain title or a position, to be elected to a certain office, etc. People establish for themselves all different types of imaginary, illusory goals. Now, when a person achieves that, there is a danger. It brings to the fore all of these emotions that are associated with his own personal, his own egotistical framework and take them completely out of the framework of reality. To the extent that a person is fully absorbed in his personal ego framework, to that extent he's lost. He's not in the world of reality anymore, in terms of what the Torah regards as reality. So you can see when people are in such a state. You can see at a certain point when people go through major experiences in their life that it does. You can say that they're not the same person until they get over it. Sometimes a person's on a tremendous high. You can see that, for example, just in a very mundane way. Let's say a person tells you they've met this girl and they fell in love. And we're talking about the intense, emotional, romantic type of love, which after a while wears off. But everybody knows about it. You can tell that during that time frame, let's say it's a few weeks or whatever the time is where he's feeling that intense love, yeah, everybody's sort of like laughing. He's like not the same person. He's in a completely different state. He's completely removed from reality. Because that consumes him. He's completely consumed by something which is totally really a fantasy. Now the only thing is that it dies out. Obviously, if it didn't, the person couldn't function. Impossible. But this was designed by the Creator. Of course, it has its purpose in order to bring people together and to cause people to have commitments and get married and so forth. This plays a role. But as everyone sees, if you study the reality of the situation, this is what people are aiming for, by the way. Most people make that feeling, the attainment of that feeling, as the... You see the extent of the distortion. That precisely to have that, that's what people say is the ultimate good, love. They're searching for love. And when they talk about love, that's exactly what they mean. The way they felt when they first fell in love. And that feeling inevitably dies off, wears off. Of course, it could be replaced by a different type of love, but that's not what people have in mind. And there are many people that keep pursuing that endlessly throughout their whole life, looking for that certain special individual with whom they will have that feeling, but on a permanent basis. Whereas it's contrary to the creation, it's contrary to reality, and it's not good. For if a person could obtain that and find, when you're in the state, you have such emotional satisfaction, you have to understand the way human being is created, that if it were possible for a person to obtain complete happiness and satisfaction from the ordinary mundane activities, then the person would be like an animal. That's basically what an animal is. That in order to be involved in the world of knowledge, you need something to prompt you, a catalyst. And that is to say, because the way we are, a person has so much psychic energy that it just can't be satisfied by these ordinary physical activities. If a person just satisfied, an animal is kind of satisfied. Its energy level is in line with its physical makeup. You just give it what it needs to eat, and it satisfies the sexual and whatever other activities, the exercise. That's it. It can sleep for hours. Its energy is satisfied. With man, it's totally different. The tremendous amount of energy can't be satisfied. A person will go crazy. They're bored. That's why they are always looking for things. Always looking for certain projects in which to satisfy their energy. Now, if a person could find that kind of a happiness in something which is not in line, not his purpose. That is to say, in romantic relationships, then that's it. Such a person would never be able to be involved in the world of knowledge, of learning. So that's the way it was designed. Now, I'm just using that as an example. Not every situation is one which calls for a karbon, of a sacrifice, but philosophically it seems to be the same idea. And...
Okay.
I would say that with this idea, perhaps we can understand the difference between the having a boy and having a girl. It's interesting to note that at the beginning of the Sedra, where it says, starts off with a woman who gives birth to a male, and she's Tomei for 7 days. Then it says, Ubayam Ashmini, Yimo Bukhara Loto. On the eighth day, they will perform Milah after the circumcision. And then it goes on to say, about the 36th day. So it's very interesting, it associates the performance of the Mitzvah of Milah with the termination of the first period of the Atoma. Now, of course, the question is, what does Mila have to do with anything? And why is Mila being brought down over here? This is not the source from which we derive the mitzvah of circumcision. We've already learned this from other sources. So it just seems out of place, completely gratuitous in this context. But I turn to you now. You'll see a connection, obviously, right?
Yeah, it fits in very nicely now.
Go ahead.
Because the whole idea of Mila is that you put the whole framework of human existence, and that's where the philosophy of Judaism is based upon.
Right.
So what happens is that when you have a male, so in the context of having a child, it's basically after 8 days, so you come to that reality a lot quicker than by a girl. Because
right, exactly.
By a male, you have that ability to see the context of why you're having children. But for a girl, you just don't have that ability. So you apparently need time in order to come to that recognition, or more amount of time.
Right, right, right. Good. The reason why it's brought down over here is because it's very relevant. That is to say that since on the eighth day, you have to perform, and of course this mitzvah is one which contains the fundamental ideas of the Torah based upon bringing your child into the covenant, into the bris, with HaKadosh Baruch Hu. So that's something which removes you, which forces you to be removed from the purely egotistical framework. And you look at it in terms of the objective framework. It's also a mitzvah which is difficult for a child, for the parent rather. It's painful for the parent. And it's something which goes contrary to the natural emotion. The natural emotion is to protect this child from any kind of pain. And here you have to take the child and subject it to such a decision, which is the since that occurs by a boy, it makes sense that the termination of the first period of Tumah is basically because of that phenomenon, that on the eighth day, you're going to be doing the mitzvah. Amila, with a girl, there is no specific mitzvah along those lines, so therefore more time is required. Okay, that's one explanation. Is there any way we can connect this with the... Sorry, no, the other side is not... It doesn't seem... like the resentfulness and all that seems to be a different aspect. So what I'm saying over here is that it's an atonement for the atonement is not for Navera, but the atonement is for the, let me just to sum up the explanation that we're just discussing now is not what the Gemara is saying, that it's an atonement for an oath which was stated under the duress, but rather the atonement over here is not for any particular sin, but for a certain state, a distorted state of the psyche which is brought about by the fulfillment of a very powerful psychological and egotistical emotion. Now, if you guys, I can leave it at this. We can come back to that, but before we do so, let's see if we can explain it or give an opening on that side. In line with the porno. He says that during this time, our thoughts are totally focused on the world of reproduction, which indicates that it's because he's consumed with the whole idea of having a child. I mean, there's two different angles. The other one is in the negative, like the depression part, the postpartum depression, you know. You know, there can be two experiences. It's interesting. There could be, sometimes a woman didn't have a tough childbirth, and she's totally thrilled and happy and like in seventh heaven kind of thing. And then you can have the other kind, where it was a painful experience. So it's a, you know, both are possible. Let me just think for a second. Well, you see from this, and I believe it's something that I heard from Rabbi Kate many years ago. But it's a long time, so I'm just reconstructing it as I understand it, is that any extreme experience, extreme experiences of pain, certainly, and we've shown even extreme experiences of pleasure, can have a completely distorting effect upon the psyche. What Ramban is referring to, and Ibn Ezra refers to, in terms of the negative thoughts, that too is part of the picture. Because it is an ambivalent picture, due to the fact that there was the punishment of the Etz of Pale Dibon. Which means to say that on the one hand, there's a powerful emotional desire, the fulfillment of the most powerful wish, that's one thing, and that itself requires an atonement. But at the same time, since as a result of the punishment, it's become associated with a lot of pain and suffering and depression. It's a very, very unpleasant, to say the least, an extreme type of a experience. So that too requires an atonement, because that too has a distorting effect upon the psyche. There's no question about that, that a person can only tolerate so much pain. And if a person is subjected to too much pain, then it's not just a matter of the effects of the pain itself. It does. Each person harbors within him a certain amount of self-love, what we call narcissism. And their relationship to God and to reality, for most people, it depends on their level of perfection, has a lot to do with how well things are going for them. And if a person becomes embittered by life experiences, it's very difficult not to blame. Which, of course, a totally perfected person, just so like Avram, serves God on there, it has nothing to do with what's happening in their life. So you see already that there's a difference between Avram and Noah. It says that Noah walked with God, and Rashi says he needed God to help him. And most of us are like that. That we can serve God, provided though, doesn't mean to say that all our wishes are being fulfilled, that's childish. But we, up to a certain point, that a person can tolerate setbacks, disappointments, and so on. But you see, when it gets really, really tough, that affects people's relationship to God. Well, why is it happening to you? So, that comes into the picture here as well. I don't think it means that, like the Ramban is saying, that she actually curses. That she actually takes an oath. If that were the case, then it would have to be treated differently. But it's metaphorical. She has those types of thoughts. That is to say, as a result of the pain that she's going through, her entire framework is distorted. Completely distorted, to the extent that she will wind up resenting and hating and not wanting to be with someone who in her normal state she is in love with, her husband she wants to be with. It's a complete distortion. Now it is necessary that when a person experiences that, and a person can experience that. This is again a paradigm, it's not the only case. People go through difficult experiences. Or now the war in Iraq, a person, this girl was captured, and you go through torment and torture. It can have a very profound effect upon a person's attitude towards life. Certainly you see in the case of people who went through the Holocaust. That's very extreme, obviously. And no one is blaming them, but the point is that it's going to embitter a person. And even if the person comes out of it, and even if consciously and officially they don't renounce Judaism or God, but on a certain psychological level, these resentful emotions are going to have a distorting impact upon the mind. So therefore extremes of both happiness and fulfillment, as well as extremes of deprivation, it all revolves around one axis, because you're talking about human narcissism. And when human narcissism is either tremendously satisfied and gratified, or tremendously violated and degraded on the other side, in either case, it produces a distortion. The same, it doesn't make any difference which one, on which side it is, it's a distortion of reality. You have a distortion of reality to the extent that you're removed from reality and completely involved in the world of self-love and ego gratification. Or that very same emotion can take you out of the world of reality to the point where you have a tremendous resentment that you can't tolerate. You can't accept the terms of human existence. And this will lead to thoughts against God. Both of those are present. And what the Rambam, what Chazal are emphasizing, perhaps, is the one that's more visible. The other one is more subtle. The more visible would be the painful aspect. The fact that there's a tremendous amount of pain and depression involved, and it's easier to make the point with regard to that, because everybody can see that. And it's as though, it doesn't mean she took an oath, but she says things, she complains. She may say it even jokingly, but it's indicative of an attitude, and that afterwards, you can't just ignore it and go on. When a person has been subjected to certain experiences which had a distorting effect upon their picture of reality, when they're out of that situation, they can't just move on. It leaves an impression. It's going to leave an impression, it's going to come out. Even if you're not feeling that way right now, but you have to introspect and review and acknowledge all of the thoughts that you had, and you have to make the necessary corrections. That's what tshuva is, and that's what I believe is about. Okay, guys?
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay.
Excellent.
Have a good Shabbos.
You too.
Okay.